From Al Jazeera English, welcome to The Debrief. I'm Laurenzio Colintinano. We're kicking off today's show with a quick reminder that you can find all of our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. So don't forget to subscribe on any of these platforms and get our new episodes delivered straight to your device. All right, now today we want to circle back to a story we told you some weeks ago. That episode was called Rape and Peacekeeping in a Forgotten Corner of Africa, and it was about sexual assault by UN peacekeepers. So back then, we heard from our correspondent Azad Essa, who had spent months investigating this issue.
I've been covering the Central African Republic civil war as such for the past 3 years. While covering that story, we found that there was a side story that was also taking place as well, like popping up. And it was a story about peacekeepers abusing the people that they were supposed to be looking after. So when you consider the madness that is taking place in the Central African Republic, you have peacekeepers in one of the most neglected areas of the world performing these heinous acts.
And to further jog your memory, Azad also told us about a 13-year-old girl from Bangui, and she had a terrible story.
We met a young girl, a teenager, on the outskirts of Bangui. She was 13 at the time when the incident took place. She was raped by a Congolese peacekeeper, and she fell pregnant, gave birth to a little boy. And the parents, when they found out about the situation, actually, they wanted to report it. But the Congolese soldier promised that he would marry her. And so for 1.5 years, they had this relationship. He would give them money and help them out with supplies and basically buying off their silence, and also the hope that, you know, maybe he'll take us to another place, you know. But he was transferred back home and he left. And so he gone, disappeared. So she went to the UN and asked or said, like, you know, I have something to report. And they're like, it's too late, like, go back home. I mean, one lady also told me this from the UN, said that they only come to complain when the guy disappears, you know. Let's forget the fact that he actually raped a minor. Basically, completely washing away the power imbalance in this relationship and the desperation of the people.
Okay, now picture this. After that episode went out, the United Nations got in touch, and they wanted to talk. So our editor, Yasser Khan, called up Atul Kare. His title is Under Secretary General for the UN Department of Field Support. What that means in real life is that he's the person who oversees what happens when a peacekeeper is accused of sexual abuse.
Mr. Kare, if you can tell me, what is the UN's current policy on responding to allegations of sexual abuse by peacekeepers in the field?
Let me begin first and foremost by reiterating that sexual abuse is indeed a global menace. I mean, it's not only a question of sexual abuse by UN peacekeepers or by other departments or agencies of the United Nations, but even outside of the United Nations. And I think what I believe is that sexual exploitation and abuse, this global menace, must cease. Now, what are we doing within that? I think first and foremost, under the new Secretary General, Mr. Antonio Guterres, we have changed our focus to focus much more on victims, putting victims at the center of our attention. And then, of course, we need to focus on ensuring accountability for the perpetrators of such acts, which involves investigations, it involves a partnership with the countries of the peacekeepers. And we also need to focus on prevention, on training, to ensure that these acts, abominable that they are not repeated. That is where we are. We do believe that our new strategy is bearing some initial fruit. In the first 11 months of this year, of course, even one allegation is an allegation too many. But we recorded 53 allegations, which is roughly half of the allegations which were recorded during the same period in 2016. So statistically, we do believe that we are seeing some results. But yes, there is a long way to traverse. I have no doubt about that.
What you've said has to do with the future. But, you know, let me go into the past for a bit.
Okay.
According to a recent investigation by the Associated Press, between 2004 and 2016, so over 12 years, the UN received almost 2,000 allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse, and these were allegations against its peacekeepers. What has been the UN response to those allegations?
In fact, most of those allegations, and I don't know if you are aware, the details which Associated Press got, they got from our public website, and we have been reporting publicly on the allegations over the last 2 years of my heading this department in a very transparent manner. I mean, quite a few of those allegations, obviously the allegations which belong to the period between 2004 to 2006, and even up to 2009, even before the Department of Field Support was actually established. We keep on looking at them. I have been following up on all the allegations. We must understand that not all allegations are substantiated after an investigation. But where the allegations are substantiated, we want to see criminal accountability, criminal actions. In some cases, or I would say in many cases, this has taken place. But there are many cases where we still continue to work with the member states to ensure that appropriate action is taken.
How many convictions would you say, sir, have there been in all this time? How many peacekeepers have been convicted, if any?
Oh, quite a few. In fact, just to tell you the recent examples, last year, and I consider it as a good example, last year we had a case which was reported against a peacekeeper from Egypt. The Egyptians, they immediately investigated, they concluded their investigation in a period slightly less than 3 months, which was exceptional. They found that the allegation of a sexual assault not amounting to rape was justified. They not only removed the peacekeeper from service, which I think was the minimum that we expected, but they also awarded a rigorous imprisonment of 5 years to this particular peacekeeper, and he's still serving his sentence in jail.
What is the investigation procedure? So let's say I'm a 14-year-old in a refugee camp in the Central African Republic, and I get raped by one of the UN peacekeepers there. What happens next? I go to you guys and say, you know, I've been raped by one of your people. What happens next?
What happens is that as soon as we get the report, that means within hours of you informing or anybody, any victim informing us, we write to the country of the nationality of the peacekeeper concerned, asking them to appoint a national investigating officer. You know, initially, about 10 years ago, the countries used to take close to 80 days to appoint a national investigating officer. This period has been brought down now to about 9 days. And the national investigating officer can either work alone, or if there is a serious case, for example, like the case of a child rape, I would want the investigation to be held conjointly with the Office of Internal Oversight Services, which is the independent body within the United Nations to investigate any case of malfeasance, misconduct, fraud, corruption, and of course, sexual exploitation and abuse. These investigations should logically be concluded, according to our memorandum of understanding, within a period of 180 days. And following these investigations, if the case is substantiated, of course, it goes through the judicial process to determine the punishment that should be awarded.
But you understand that who is responsible at the end of the day? A UN peacekeeper who has been accused of committing rape, let's say against an adult or a child, who is ultimately responsible and who is the ultimate arbiter of justice in this scenario? Is it the UN or is it the country that that soldier comes from?
No, the country from where the soldier comes from, because the United Nations, you would appreciate, does not have its own criminal laws. It cannot. It's an international organization, not a member state. And therefore, the member state which is deploying the soldier is responsible, but we take a special interest to see that the justice is actually done, that the people do not go scot-free.
Mm-hmm. So isn't this sort of, you know, different countries have different laws and different attitude towards sexual abuse. How do you, as the United Nations, maintain a standard of justice when your peacekeepers are from several different countries that have several different legal attitudes towards sexual abuse. How do you ensure that victims, whether it be in Pakistan or in the Central African Republic, get the same quality of justice as opposed to, you know, justice varying depending on what country the soldier was from?
I think this is a very, very important question, and I agree with you that this is a major challenge. For example, United Nations defines, according to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, any person below the age of 18 as a child. And therefore, we define any sexual contact with a person below the age of 18 as, by definition, sexual abuse. But then you know that the age of consent, the age of marriage is different in different countries. And this has been a challenge for us. But from the United Nations viewpoint, and this we make clear to all countries concerned, that there are certain minimum standards, for example, which I mentioned to you, that for us the age of consent has to be beyond the age of 18 years and not below, even though that may be recognized as such. Another problem. Which comes, for me, prostitution is by definition sexual exploitation and unacceptable. But then, peacekeepers are deployed in some countries where prostitution is legal, and they may come from some countries where prostitution is legal. Now, this creates a very major legal lacuna, how to deal with this case of prostitution, which according to internal UN rules, we consider sexual exploitation, and therefore we will remove the person from our service. I mean, that's a minimum which we can do. But how to deal with criminally when it is not an offense either in the country where it happened or in the country of the nationality of the peacekeeper. So from the viewpoint of those countries, no crime has been committed.
Right. And how do you deal with that?
This is a major problem. We are trying to work with all the member states to deal with these issues of consent and of what I would call transactional sex. You know, I'm trying to define it slightly differently from sexual exploitation and abuse. But yes, these are two very big problems which we have, and we do not yet have solutions. I agree.
But in the meantime, Mr. Kare, there are still kids and women and men who are being sexually abused. You must have some you must have some measures in place that would mitigate those things.
Yeah. No, for example, if there is a question of rape, I mean, there is no country which can accept rape as consent. I mean, that is impossible. And there we follow up. And to my mind, the majority of cases which we get actually are what I would define as transactional sex, statutory rape, sexual assault, and consensual sex leading to paternity, where we actually do not have only one victim, we have two victims, because then there is a question of child support to be provided
That's
for the
right.
child which is born. And where we are assisting the countries to do DNA testing. We collect the DNA of the mother, of the child. We get it verified against the DNA of the presumed father. And in many such cases, from Uruguay through to Tanzania, fathers have been identified and child support has been provided, including inter alia.
But, you know, Mr. Kare, we reported in our previous podcast of a young woman in Bangui who was assaulted by a UN peacekeeper. She subsequently felt pregnant. And while the UN peacekeeper was in country, she was, you know, he provided the family with some level of support, I suppose, you know, food and whatnot, with a promise to marry the girl. And then, of course, he was transferred out. And she's never got justice. And there's literally hundreds of cases like this.
No,
you have said that, you know, you are transparent in reporting, but, you know, reporting isn't, I'm sure you'd agree, reporting and transparency isn't justice. How would you address all of this backlog of cases that you have on your desk and have so far gone unresolved? Because sexual assault, obviously, you know, very few cases where sexual assault is reported immediately. Sometimes it's reported days, months, weeks, even years later. This seems to be an ongoing problem for you guys.
Yeah, and I think the only way we can do it is through partnership with the member states, because accountability is a shared responsibility between both us and the member states. And I think we will just have to continue. I agree. It is frustrating for us, and it is even more frustrating and horrible, I would say, for the victims to wait for justice almost, I would say, indefinitely, if not for a long period of time. And that is why we are promoting some changes. And some countries are following our advice. For example, Republic of South Africa, in Democratic Republic of Congo, we requested them that why don't they do their court martials inside Democratic Republic of Congo so that the victims can actually see the justice which is being done. And this is one country which has done so. I acknowledge its contribution towards greater accountability. And I agree with you that transparency in itself is not accountability. I mean, accountability is at least to my mind at three different levels. First, support to victims, which has been, I would say, an issue which did not get the prominence which it deserved till the time our Secretary General took over on 1st of January earlier this year. Second level of accountability is to ensure that there is due criminal accountability. And third level of accountability is to ensure that in some cases we have sent the entire peacekeeping contingent back and saying that no, till the performance.
What case would that be, sir?
Sorry?
Which case is that?
Those cases are essentially two so far. The first is a contingent from Democratic Republic of Congo, where there were a large number of cases, including inter alia in Bangui. I know the case which you are talking about, which is a case which is currently being adjudicated by the legal system of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which are dealing with, I think, around 12 cases from the Central African Republic. That contingent is no longer participating in peacekeeping. And a smaller company from Republic of Congo was withdrawn by the country itself, by Republic of Congo, upon our request when we found that there were a number of cases alleged against that particular company in a place called Dekoa in the Central African Republic.
Okay. So let's say you remove the contingent of soldiers and you have a, you know, you convince some countries to court-martial their soldiers within the country of where the crime is committed.
Correct.
What of the victims, sir? What, you know, reparations or how do you take care of the victims?
Yeah, I think on the victims, there are three steps which I would say. First is immediate medical and psychosocial support if the case is reported to us within days or weeks, not within years, because then the system is slightly different. I mean, the needs are also slightly different. Second, it depends upon the case. For example, as I told you, when it came to a question of a child born out of a relationship between a peacekeeper and a national of the host country, we need to ensure that the child gets a proper birth certificate, a proper nationality certificate, and certain amount of allowance for their development, upkeep, education, health, and food and clothing. Some countries, for example, I know Uruguay is one of them. They are deducting money regularly from the salary of the peacekeeper who is now a soldier in their country and depositing it in a bank account which was designated by the mother of the child in Haiti. Some countries where peacekeepers have sort of disappeared. This happened with one case. You know, this was a case of a major from Sri Lanka. And where he is now, we don't know. I mean, he's not in Sri Lanka. Maybe he's out. Maybe he has dumped his passport. And upon our request, the authorities of Sri Lanka made a sort of a trust fund with a reasonable amount of money, which I don't want to disclose in a podcast, whose interest is taking care of the needs of the child again in Haiti. But such cases have to be expanded. They are currently anecdotal. They are very few. And I want, really speaking, the message to go across through this podcast that all of us together have a responsibility not only for, as I said, psychosocial and medical support to the victims, where we have created a trust fund, which now has about $1.5 million, and we are working on that mostly with projects in Democratic Republic of Congo and Central African Republic. Second, on the side of criminal accountability, where we need the effective partnership of member states, and third, long-term care of the children born out of such liaisons.
Two more questions for you, Mr. Khadr. First one, you know, so I understand the procedure is that the UN works with the country from which the soldiers are from in order to get any kind of justice.
Yes.
Whatever kind of justice that might be available. Forgive me, sir, but what would you say if I were to tell you that this sounds like the UN and its agencies are washing their hands off the problem and shoving the problem onto the member states as opposed to, the providing country, as opposed to the UN taking action on its own?
Yeah, the UN does take some actions on its own, and which I'll explain to you later on, but there is a legal issue. The countries in the memorandum of understanding which they sign with us, when they provide their soldiers, they absolutely insist that they retain the right taking judicial action in case of any criminal accountability. There is not only a question of sexual exploitation and abuse. There may be a case of fraud. There may be a case of, pilfering of United Nations rations, which are provided to them. In all these cases, the ultimate judicial accountability rests with them. It is true because UN also does not have a court, and UN does not have its own criminal laws because it's an international organization.
One of the a senior military person who we interviewed in Bangui had said that he tells his soldiers not to sexually exploit the locals because it would bring shame on the country. Is that the UN's line that, you know, this is unbecoming of a soldier rather than why not tell the soldiers don't rape people?
No, I will tell much more. I think any sexual exploitation and abuse, it's more than rape. For me, even an attempted sexual assault, which may not result in rape, is sexual exploitation and abuse. And I would say that this is contrary to the principles and purposes of the United Nations. I would say that it is illegal. I would say that beyond all this, it is something for which they will be held responsible by their own country's national judicial systems. So it is a illegal and criminal activity, pure and simple. Insofar as shame on the countries is concerned, I think the shame is actually on the individual, not on the country. The shame question of the country comes if the country does not take the required actions to investigate and does not take the required judicial actions to ensure criminal accountability. As I said in the beginning, we have a long way to traverse. I am the first to acknowledge that. But the countries are improving their performance on both investigation and on action.
Mr. Kare, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Yasir.
There's no better and more proud way to end this episode than with a big shout out to our journalist Azad Issa, because the United Nations recently awarded his work on this story a silver medal in the United Nations Correspondents Association International Prize. Azad and we at The Debrief will continue to bring you in-depth stories like this one, holding the powerful to account. And next week, as I had promised, we're going to the Philippines because we're taking a closer look at President Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs. See you then.